are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, October 12, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. Darn it, five times. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Bureau Chief of the HuffPost, Amanda Turkle. On the 26 years since we first publicly began to address sexual harassment. Also on the program, Trump today signing an executive order continuing the assault on Americans' health care. And when the IMF says your tax cuts for the rich are bad, you know you have a problem. Meanwhile, Puerto Rico slides into catastrophe, and the U.S. government wants to give it a big push. Wildfires in Northern California continue to rage as power lines may be implicated. And the Charlottesville fascist beating victim apparently was issued a warrant by a neo-Confederate. You have a very strange system of crime fighting down there. And Trump mad that America has a news media. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We spoke about this, yesterday, but there is increasing reason to believe that people in the administration have increasing reason to believe that Donald Trump is losing it. Now, we've gotten these reports from time to time, and maybe this is the way it's going to go. There's going to be a roller coaster quality to this. There'll be an ebb and flow. Sort of probably like, you know, in your daily life. Sometimes things are good and sometimes things are bad. Sometimes the president is on the brink of some type of breakdown. And sometimes he's just a horrible human being. But I was on Chris Hayes last night, and we were discussing the reports of his meeting in July where he wanted to have 10 times more nukes than we have now. And it was based upon a graph that he was shown. Because remember, they have to show him pictures for just about everything. A graph that showed our nuclear stockpile was at its lowest ebb since the Cold War. Or I guess, since the end of World War II. Which makes sense when you think about it. If you have the capacity to think about it. And he didn't like the fact that he was president when the line was down towards the bottom as opposed to the top. So he said, I want to go back to the top. And this is the meeting after which Rex Tillerson said, the president is an effing moron, which now seems rather understated. But that report was given, came out in either Vanity Fair or the Washington Post. I can't recall at the moment. But it was sourced by three officials in the room. you got to wonder why those three officials are talking about this now. And I don't know if it was, I mean, it's possible. We don't know who was in that room. Maybe those three officials were Sean Spicer, Reince Priebus, and some other of the 15 people who have been fired from the administration. And this has nothing to do with where they're at right now, where the president's at right now. Or maybe it's people who are around the president now and are very concerned about what's going on with the president. Maybe when Bob Corker comes out and says this stuff, he's saying it because he's trying to send us a message. I don't know what we're supposed to do with that message, but it certainly raises concerns. And so, I don't know, this is sort of like when I was a kid, when there was the Iranian embassy hostage crisis, and Ted Koppel started his show at, I think it was like 11 o'clock at night. And it was supposed to be, it ultimately became Nightline. But when it was first started, it was just day one of the Iranian hostage crisis. And I think it went to day 512. I don't remember. But every night, that's what it was. That was what the title of the show was. Day two of the Iranian hostage crisis. And then I think they realized, like, oh, there's a market here. We'll just call it Nightline. But we're sort of living, I sort of feel like maybe we should just rename the show. Like, where are we now? Day, like, 200 of the American hostage crisis. And just as horrible as this is for most of the people listening to this, just imagine if you were a 25-year-old who was brought to this country when you were 10 or 7 or 2 or 12. By your parents, and you don't know whether sometime over the next 9, 12, 15 months, you're going to be deported to that country where maybe you haven't been since you were 2. So there's different levels of different circles of hell here, I guess, that we're all living in the Trump administration. But Donald Trump has some good news for you. As you know, when he took office, our national debt was $20 trillion. Sounds like a lot of money. It is. We could, of course, print it if we want to, but let's not get into modern monetary theory at the moment. He's on with Sean Hannity, who apparently he calls on a regular basis after Sean's show is over. Reports are that Donald Trump had to cancel his 60 Minutes interview because they are worried about him being in any type of scenario which might in any way be taxing or challenging to him. And I think this clip explains why. Here is Donald Trump. I think he's trying to explain something about debt. I think. But here it is.
My second interview since you've been president. You guys want to start with good news? We do have some good news.
Go ahead.
Right? You don't get a lot of good news in the media.
Well, you don't get so much.
The market's up 25% since you were won. You tweeted this out that nobody in the media brings it up. So I said, you know what? I'm going to bring it up tonight. $5.2 trillion in wealth created. We have the lowest unemployment rate in 16 years. We have the best labor participation rate in 7 years and the lowest number of people on food stamps in 7 years.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's going really well. I'm loving it. I'm doing a job for the people and people are seeing that.
Pause it. Is there a single policy that he's implemented that implicates the economy at all at this point? I mean, I'm sure, I know there's not one that caused the economy to react in this way. But I just wonder if there's even one that implicates the economy whatsoever. Can anybody come up with one?
He brought the jobs back.
Oh, well, he brought the jobs back, of course. All right, well, here's where he's going to explain his how he did this, the economic magic that he is, the alchemy that he has created.
People are seeing that, and I'm so proud of the $5.2 trillion of increase in the stock market. Now, if you look at the stock market, that's one element, but then we have many other elements. The country, we took it over, it owed $20 trillion. As you know, the last 8 years, they borrowed more than it did in the whole history of our country. So they borrowed more than $10 trillion, right? And yet we picked up $5.2 trillion just in the stock market, possibly picked up the whole thing in terms of the first 9 months, in terms of value. So you could say in one sense, we're really increasing values, and maybe in a sense, we're reducing debt. But we're very honored by it, and we're very, very happy with what's happening on Wall Street.
Yeah, now, there is no sense in which you could say that. He said, in one sense, you could say that we're increasing value and decreasing debt. No, there's no sense in which you could say that. I mean, I guess if the only people who own stocks were the government of the United States and stock values had gone up $5.2 trillion, and then the government sold all its stocks, took all that money off the table, and put it into the treasury, I guess you could say that. But there's no sense other than that, which is not the case, that, that one could say that. So I'm glad he's feeling very honored about it. But yeah, it's every single other person who heard those words. And I would imagine even Sean Hannity, if he went back, got very, very disturbed at the level of confusion that seems to be on the most basic of things.
I'd say it's 50-50 that Hannity noticed. It's anything.
50. Well, no, I'm not saying he noticed. I'm saying it's possible that if he went back because someone said, hey, you should go check that out. He went, oh, yeah, that was, I think he was just, he was tired from flying. That's what that, I think you would probably say there. That's, that is some gold-plated dum-dum right there. That is not good. Last night, I was I mentioned that I was on MSNBC. So as you see, I am cleanly shaven. Although, I mean, I didn't shave this morning, of course. And regular listeners will know how I got that way. For decades, one big razor company has been relentlessly increasing prices and reaped immense profits at the expense of its customers. Guess what? I don't use that company. Because Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who were fed up with getting ripped off, started Harry's to fix shaving. I don't know why that didn't occur to me, because I definitely was unhappy with how much I was paying with razors at that time. Harry's knew there was only one way to ensure quality, so they bought their own blade factory. By taking less profit, selling directly to you over the internet, Harry's offers their blades at half the price, just $2 a blade compared to $4 or more you pay at the drugstore. You all know why I love Harry's. It's hard for me to break it down, but I would say the majority is I don't like to pay a lot for my razors. I want to come off as cheap, but I'm a spendthrift. But I also, the ergonomic handles, I don't like those ones that make me feel like I have got to be Rambo. These are just a little more classy, in my opinion. Harry's is so confident that you're going to love their blades. They're going to give you a trial set for free. All you got to do is cover the shipping. Your free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, which I already mentioned to you, a 5 precision engineered blade with lubricating strip and the trimmer blade for people who have some nose issues like I do, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. It's a $13 value for you to try. Stop messing around. Get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your free trial offer. If there's any of my listeners who have not started using Harry's, I'd be shocked at this point. I guess I shouldn't say that because then they would stop advertising with us, but I would say that I know there's a couple of you. You can get a $13 value for free. All you got to do is just cover shipping. to get your free trial set, including a razor handle, five-blade cartridge, and shave gel. Go to harrys.com/majority report right now. That's harrys.com/majority report. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Amanda Turkle, she wrote a great piece about the Anita Hill hearings. And I figure with everybody in the office right now, we're just babies at that time. Young children at best. Brendan, were you even born? Here we go.
When did the hearings begin?
1991.
In October?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God.
I'm a Scorpio. It was a little later.
All right. There you go, folks. This is what I walk into every single day. Good time to revisit those Anita Hill hearings, and what the mentality was in our public to these questions. Take a quick break. We'll be right back with Amanda Turkle. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program writer with HuffPo, Amanda Turkle. Amanda, what is your specific title there at HuffPo?
I am the Washington Bureau Chief over here.
Oh, okay. Washington Bureau Chief. I'm sorry. My apologies. Congratulations,
that's
too.
Fine. Thank you.
And it's HuffPo, not Huffington Post anymore.
It's HuffPost, actually.
HuffPost. All right.
HuffPost.
Well, the research department here at the Majority Report is on vacation at the moment, so we will we'll note that for the future. All right. Well, I want to talk about this because in my studio now are people who I'm quite afraid were either prenatal or just out of the womb when Anita Hill was testifying against Clarence Thomas. I remember those hearings is when I began to take pictures of my television and making refrigerator magnets to buy beer. So just to give a sense of why I feel compelled to make sure that people in this this room and in the audience recall this, because you make the argument, I think, in this piece, which focuses around Joe Biden's role to a certain extent, that this was sort of the seminal moment in, broadly speaking, in the country's awareness of sexual harassment in the workplace.
Right. It's not the first time that sexual harassment occurred, obviously.
Right.
The point of this was that it was going on. It was something that was happening to many women, but it was also considered normal. It was just figured that this is what happens. A lot of men didn't even see this as anything wrong. It was just how you behaved in the workplace. But when Anita Hill went public in October 1991 and said that this is what happened to me and I don't think it's right, it was sort of a wake-up call for a lot of women and men in the country who suddenly had a name for this and felt like they could talk about it, because, as you said, it was on TV and just everyone was watching it.
Yeah, give us a sense of you know, where Anita Hill was coming from in terms of her politics and sort of just broadly speaking, her disposition towards Clarence Thomas, because I think, like, today, the first, in the event that something like this happened in the context of a political accusation, there, it seems to me, it would be immediately about the sort of partisan politics. This was a different era, too, I guess.
Yes. So Anita Hill is, you hear this now, even when women come forward, that they want fame, they want attention. If they're accusing a Republican, oh, she must be a Democratic plant and she just wants to help Democrats win office. Anita Hill was not like that. She was not particularly political. And she didn't really, you know, want to come forward and start a movement about sexual harassment. She did not sort of feel like she needed to step in, but when she was asked about, she had told a few people her story about what had happened when she worked for Clarence Thomas. And then when people said that he's being nominated for the Supreme Court, will you talk to us about it? She did so, and she did so rather reluctantly, but she felt that she had a civic duty to give the public the full picture of what was going on with this man she had worked for. So she was not, she definitely wasn't some sort of political crusader trying to make a message. She simply was asked questions and she answered.
And I'm trying to sort of also paint a picture for people today, because I think it's very hard for folks to sort of, and 93 was, you know, very, was probably the last time in many respects that there was genuine, and maybe genuine is overstated, but a you know, that was the really the old boys network, and everybody, you know, across the aisle, there's my buddy, and there was a Senate, you know, collegiality, that type of thing. And I hope people know that I'm saying this with a little bit of jaundice, because I think it was problematic, frankly. But that it was, there was just seems to be, you know, in reading your piece, a broad uncomfortability by all the men. I mean, it was all men, right? Except for two senators, I think, at that point. With
yeah, just two female senators.
The whole topic. So just give us a sense of like the timeline and what, you know, the different sort of, I guess, perceptions of Joe Biden in that role, because he was the chair of this, of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Right. And the Senate Judiciary Committee was all male, all white. And so that's what Anita Hill had to go up against when she was trying to convince these men of what Clarence Thomas had done to her and why it was a problem. And Joe Biden was sort of riding high. He had helped take down Robert Bork and kept him off the Supreme Court. And he wanted to sort of show what he could do again, that he was this serious guy when he took on Clarence Thomas. And Anita Hill messed that up a little bit, because the revelations about what Clarence Thomas did to her came out after the Senate Judiciary Committee had already voted and agreed to send Thomas's nomination to the floor for a vote. It came out just 2 days before they were supposed to vote on his nomination on the full floor. And so the senators honestly just thought this was a pain. You know, it's too late. Why do we have to deal with this? Let's just vote and move on with it. But it was because of there was a small group of women who were in the House who helped press Biden, who helped press the Democratic majority leader to say that, no, you have to look, you have to delay these hearings. Otherwise, Democrats, women in the country will be mad. Thomas may not go through. You have to, you know, you have to stop this. And so it was the women in Congress and women's advocacy groups. Now, Biden said that he understood that sexual harassment was bad. It was a problem. But his main, what people were mostly frustrated about was that he seemed to give too much deference to Clarence Thomas. Anita Hill, for example, only got to testify once. Clarence Thomas got to testify both before and after her and in the primetime hour. So if you were watching, you probably saw Clarence Thomas. He also didn't bring forward key witnesses who could have backed Anita Hill's story up. And he has lots of reasons for why. But ultimately, the system was rigged against Anita Hill.
That, you know, that the latter part there, because, I mean, I remember following these hearings fairly closely. Like I say, I think I still have refrigerator magnets that I made out of pictures of the television at that time. And the stories of the three witnesses who would have at least in part corroborated something of a pattern that Clarence Thomas had engaged in, that seemed to me, nobody heard of that. I mean, it didn't even seem to be much reporting about that. I didn't even realize that they had actually given testimony, because it was never made, I mean, I guess it wasn't private, but it wasn't public either.
Right, absolutely not. I mean, one woman had worked with Clarence Thomas, and she said that Thomas had asked her all sorts of inappropriate questions about her physical appearance, had tried to pressure her to date him, and very similar things to what Anita Hill was saying. and she was not, she never got to testify publicly. A woman who knew about this behavior, because this woman, Angela Wright, had told her about it, also didn't get to testify. And then there was another woman who also had worked for Clarence Thomas, who said that, you know, the type of behavior that Anita Hill is describing is not surprising at all. That fits exactly with what I knew of Clarence Thomas as well. Those three women could have helped Anita Hill. So it wasn't just her out there, you know, with Republicans out there saying that if Clarence Thomas really did this and it was so bad, why did she keep working for him? You know, she clearly just wants to get attention. Right. It seemed consensual. She was in love with Clarence Thomas. Things that you still hear about women who come forward to talk about sexual harassment today. But there were three other women who could have helped Anita Hill. Joe Biden had the power to bring them before the committee, and he never did it.
That still seems to be the, I mean, you know, and it's amazing. So we're 25 years out, and we still sort of have not. I don't have a sense. I don't know if we have improved in the workplace at all. I would imagine that we have. I'd like to think we have. But in terms of like accusations, there still seems to be a lot more strength in numbers, right? And you know, one can imagine that if there were three women or two, or, you know, women who would corroborate that type of behavior 26 years ago, gosh knows how many other women there were, right? I mean, you know, because it just seems to me that we're now, you know, I don't know when I would peg this to, but in an era where it's just a little bit easier for women to come out, particularly when there's multiple women. There's just a sense that at one point now the scrutiny and the recriminations are less if there's more than one woman who talks about a situation like this.
Right. And that's why the stories against Bill Cosby, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, Harvey Weinstein have been so
Donald,
powerful.
Donald Trump.
And Donald Trump, of course, is because there have been multiple women. And it's very hard to be the first woman to come out,
yes,
and make those accusations and be alone. And with Roger Ailes, you saw it was Gretchen Carlson, someone who had a significant amount of money on her own. So she could bring something like this, and was you know, quite famous. So she sort of had those means and resources that some other women don't have. But, you know, that's why this Anita Hill story was so remarkable, was she didn't have any of that. She was a law professor at the time when she went forward and testified. And she didn't really have any powerful backers like Clarence Thomas did, who had the entire Republican Party and the, you know, George H.W. Bush White House behind him. And she went forward and she was left there alone by many of these men who were supposed to be her allies. But yes, these stories that are resonating today, you know, shows that when one woman steps up, more women are willing to do it. And that's when it really snowballs.
That's an amazing part of the story, too, is that there was no one in any way mentoring her or acting as her advocate through this process, because that seems to me to be, you know, rare, right? I mean, it's impossible almost to imagine someone playing that type of role, you know, in something like a Supreme Court hearing without them, you know, being in regular contact with one senator's office or, you know, a couple of congresspeople's office and having staffers, you know, help them and prep them. And she didn't seem to have any of that. I mean, none of that. She was just sort of like thrown into this maelstrom. And I do mean maelstrom. Metzenbaum, apparently, Senator Metzenbaum said, there was a quote in your piece where he said something to the effect of like, half the Senate could probably be accused of this.
Right. If that's sexual harassment, then half the senators are doing it. And Biden, what you said about not having a patron, this was something that really bothered Hill. I mean, Joe Biden had called her to convince her that he was on her side. And he said, according to Anita Hill, "Aw, kiddo, I feel for you. I wish I weren't the chairman. I'd come be your lawyer." But Anita Hill never felt like Biden was on her side. He felt like his smile was fake and that he never really helped her. And she said, "My sin was not simply that I did not have a patron, nor was it simply that I rejected patronage offered to me since none was offered. And she said that her, you know, what was seen as a sin was she didn't pursue this patronage. She thought that she could step forward, tell her side of the story, and it would be received, you know, as it was, factually, truthfully, whatever. And it just wasn't.
Yeah. So tell us, I mean, just give me a sense of the implications of that, because, you know, when the first thing I thought about when I was reading your piece was like, when was Bob Packwood? And Bob Packwood, and maybe you can just fill this out, but he was a senator from, I think it was Oregon or Washington State, a Republican, who was one of the first guys to introduce, I can't remember if it was protections, abortion protections, or he introduced fairly progressive legislation that feminists supported. And then he was brought down by about, like, I think a dozen accusations from staffers of I don't know if it was fully sexual assault. I can't remember, frankly. But and he was drummed out of the Senate. And it seems to me a lot of that must have been a sensitivity that came out of Anita Hill's experience.
Right. So I did not remember the date either, but he ended up resigning in 95. And ultimately, 19 women came forward with claims of sexual abuse and sexual assault. And you're right. It had a lot to do with Anita Hill, because after Anita Hill spoke out in 1991, women really made 1992 a year when they decided that they were going to get more women elected to office. And it wasn't necessarily a coordinated thing. There were just, you know, I talked to a lot of female lawmakers who came to Congress at that time, and they said just watching Anita Hill's testimony just electrified them and electrified the country. And they just, you know, seeing her go up against this all these white men on the Judiciary Committee who didn't seem to understand what she was facing really got to them. And so in 1992, there were 20 new Democratic women who were elected to the House. Emily's List, which is the pro-choice Democratic group dedicated to electing women, went from 3,000 to 24,000 members. It was, you know, her testimony launched a political movement.
What do you think? I mean, just lastly, what was it that did it? Was it people being inspired by her courage? Was it women sort of saying like, it's clear this has gone on long enough? I mean, what was the impetus, do you think?
I think it was a little bit of both. It was certainly her courage. You know, if Anita Hill can get up and do this, you know, I need to do something too. But I think it was also outrage. It's just seeing that these men just didn't know what they were doing, and that they felt like they didn't have representation in Congress. And so they were going to run and they were going to do something about it. You know, it was not a good time for, it was not a good look for the Senate. And, you know, Joe Biden, even after that, he wanted Barbara Boxer, when she was elected, to join the Judiciary Committee and to woo her, to get her to be on the committee. He sent over a dozen red roses. You know, that's not the way to ask a senator to join your committee. It's like he's trying to ask her on a date or something.
Oh,
so even, you know, with Biden, who I think people will acknowledge had good intentions and was generally on their side and has since obviously done quite a bit of good work, you know, he was just, he didn't understand it either. There was just no, there weren't enough women in the Senate and in Congress to sort of educate these men about what women were going through.
And what's amazing, too, is that Anita Hill, it seems to me, could have been, had she wanted to, had she been a sort of like a public person with aspirations of that ilk, she could have led any number of these organizations, I imagine. And she seemed to just want to be left alone.
Right, exactly. Anita Hill could have led these organizations. She could have run for office. But she just wanted to be a law professor. She wanted to practice law. She never really wanted to be in the spotlight. And since then, she's had a fairly low profile. She wrote something, an op-ed the other day around the Harvey Weinstein stuff, and she'll occasionally talk about her experiences and talk about sexual harassment. But for the most part, you know, she lives a fairly private life.
Amanda Turkle, Washington Bureau Chief of HuffPost, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, folks, going to head into the fun half in a moment, but want to talk about the presidential signing today. He signed some executive orders that are really going to debilitate the Affordable Care Act. Now, as you know, there are a lot of problems with the Affordable Care Act, not the least of which is that it's not so affordable. But as I've said many times in the past, the PP part of the PPACA is really the part that I think has value, and that is the patient protections. In other words, prior to the Affordable Care Act, many people, most people's insurance was actually barely insurance at all. But because of the nature of getting sick and having large medical bills is what it is. That being that 5% of people end up responsible for 50% of the costs of medical care in this country. 20% of the people end up responsible for 80% of the medical care costs. Most people do not realize or did not realize how bad their insurance was until it was too late. You can walk around with fire insurance for your house and think it's great until the day after your house burns down and you find out, oh, it doesn't cover fire that comes from fire. And that's basically what we had with health insurance. I mean, the biggest, the most, and this is also putting aside, of course, the expansion of Medicaid. But the most telling number is that you halved at least the number of bankruptcies in this country as a function of medical expenses, which prior to the Affordable Care Act was half of all personal bankruptcies. So it had a positive impact, if not as broad and as deep of one as we wanted. What the president is doing today is fundamentally hobbling the Affordable Care Act. And here is his signing. He's so excited about destroying healthcare for so many people that he actually forgot to sign the bill again. Here he is.
We will have great healthcare in our country. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
There he is, shaking Rand Paul's hand. Rand Paul, largely responsible for how bad this went. And there's Mike Pence going over there. Mr. President? Mr. President? Oh, you go.
I'm only signing it because it costs nothing.
Forgot to sign. Mike Pence had to go over. And there's Rand Paul standing right next to him. And Rand Paul is there because the executive order really puts into place a lot of what Rand Paul wanted, which is the ability for insurance companies and for group plans to sell insurance that really is garbage insurance. This is the equivalent in healthcare of the phone call we got from a libertarian who was like, you know, you should have let the American government should have let Ford sell the Pinto that explodes in the back. Because some people might want a lower price car. And of course, you'd have to sell the Pinto for less than an average car because it explodes. There's some problems that are associated with that in society. but very similar problems. One is, if I didn't buy the Pinto, I just happened to be near it when it explodes. Hey, I don't get a discount on anything. I just get blown up. And society is going to end up having to pay for people who don't have proper health care coverage. So what we're seeing is a multi-pronged effort to undermine the Affordable Care Act. And maybe over the next couple of days, we'll try and get that guy Andy Slavitt on, who was a former, I think, Health and Human Services official in the Obama administration. And he has been writing about this quite a bit. He ran Medicare, Medicaid, and the ACA for Obama. But basically, the executive order today comes in the wake of the Trump administration having, maybe I guess they cut it 41% is more specifically, the funding for healthcare navigators. So that was a program which provided funding to community organizations. Maybe they were organizations that helped the homeless. Maybe they were organizations that provided health care for women. Maybe they were organizations that ran some type of after-school programs where they would have contact with people who were eligible for either Medicaid or subsidies in the exchange. That would be people from living within 133% to 400% of poverty. And these navigators would say, hey, you're eligible for XYZ. I'm going to help you with this. If you have questions during the course of the year, I'm going to help you with those questions. State after state after state, you're seeing these navigators having to shut down because of the money that was cut from them. A group in Michigan, the Michigan Consumers for Healthcare, nonprofit group, enrolled thousands of people in health insurance under the ACA. Their budget for assisting consumers right before open enrollment period begins in, I don't know, 3 weeks, is going to be cut 89% from $1.2 million to $129,000. They're going to have to fire everybody. You're going to see a lot less people sign up for these programs on the exchanges. What happens to insurance when few people are in the what we call the risk pool? It becomes riskier and more expensive, and those costs must be passed on to the consumer. And what we have today is sort of the next step in that plan in making insurance more expensive on the exchanges. The executive order allows for association health plans. This is plans to be offered with no pre-existing conditions coverage, very little of the essential benefits. In some instances, it's possible, I think, you could have things like rescission, lifetime caps. And if I'm to offer you a Ford Pinto, I can do so at a cut rate because a lot of people don't necessarily want a car that blows up. And Ford realizes, like, we got to get these things off the lot. So I can sell you your Pinto, and instead of buying a functioning car, in the context of this metaphor, in the healthcare exchanges, you're going to buy the Pinto. You may find out one day that the car explodes. You may not. But in the meantime, the only people who are going to be left in the exchange are the people who really need to rely on their health insurance. Or perhaps they have a pre-existing health condition and they cannot get health insurance outside of the exchanges. And so the exchanges are just going to become increasingly more expensive and untenable. And that's the plan, essentially. You're just going to crash the exchanges. And I guess they'll go after Medicaid when they start doing the budget stuff. But that's what we're seeing. They're going to crash the exchanges in most of the state, in many of the states around the country. There'll be some big states like New York and California that will prop them up. But this is what we can anticipate around the country. And then I guess stage three is go back to the Democrats and say, we need to stabilize this. Let's cut a deal. So really, the bottom line is people just need to be aware that the Republicans are purposely blowing up the insurance markets. And then we go from there. Because the danger here is, and even if you're a single-payer supporter like myself, is that the next step for them is government can't do anything right when it comes to healthcare. They're not going to say, hey, look, this mix of private stuff and subsidizing private corporations was a mistake, et cetera, et cetera. That's not what we're going to hear. That's not going to be the rhetoric. That's not what they're going to run on. They're going to run on, this is what happens when you let the government take over healthcare. So it's really important that people understand that this is a purposeful sabotaging. I mean, from a political standpoint, purposeful sabotaging of a flawed but functioning system. So because this is going to be the fight in 20, could very well be the fight in 2018, because there's going to be some real problems in the health insurance sector going forward. All right, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun sector of the show. Tomorrow on the program, Vic Berger will be here to give us a movie suggestion. I wonder if he'll just suggest like one of his short movies.
They're my favorite movies that have been coming out for the past like 2 years, is Vic Berger's take on reality.
Now, didn't he become like a star on, was it Vine?
I think that sounds right. I mean, I think he does work with like Tim and Eric.
I can't even remember what Vine was now. I feel like that was so long ago. Do you guys even remember Vine?
Vine was my favorite social media of all time.
Oh, all right. Then there you go.
R.I.P.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. We cannot do this daily show without you. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And when you do, we say thank you. But we don't just say thank you. In fact, we don't even say thank you. I mean, we don't. It's all via email that we contact you. So we don't actually say anything. I mean, we do around here, but you'll never hear it. The point is, we give you something. We give you sometimes a half an hour, but more often than not, an hour or 90 minutes of extra content every single day that we do it. So, and you also get commercial free. The free show becomes commercial free for you. And we've got all sorts of other things planned, don't we, Matt?
Well, I was just going to say I'm responsible for the artisanal ad removal, and I take a lot of pride in that job.
That does it. For a while, he did it with a machine, and then he just did it by hand.
I whittle them out of the MP3.
Matt, let me tell you something, how dedicated he is to pulling those ads out for our members. He takes the audio. He converts it to tape. We have a huge reel-to-reel in the back of the office. He converts it to tape, and then by hand, he takes a very sharp blade.
It takes about 20 minutes just to sharpen the blade every day.
Cuts it out, then uses some type of special tape, right? It's not like Scotch tape. And he tapes it back together, runs it through the reel-to-reel that he's somehow jerry-rigged. He's got one of those reel-to-reels that also has a USB cord. And puts it back into the machine and posts it.
That was a modification I put in there.
And of course, before he does it, he puts on his nice leather blouse thingy. That he wears. So, folks, You're really going to enjoy Matt's work in cutting out the ad today. Meanwhile, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy a crap from Amazon or Jet.com, do so through our link at MajorityReportKickback.com. Don't forget, did you miss too much Michael Brooks, TMBS this week? The Michael Brooks Show? You can check it out on iTunes, or you can check it out on our YouTube channel. All right, quick break. We'll be right back. 646-257-3920.